With the second section of the fourth chapter on Karma Yoga. So yesterday we were discussing about how the intricacies of karma are difficult to understand. And in that connection, Lord Krishna mentioned that one who is intelligent is one who sees action in inaction and inaction in action. So with respect to the specific context of Arjuna, what this means is that action in inaction. Arjuna's main concern is that he will get bad karma if he fights and he kills his relatives. But if Arjuna chooses to be inactive, so now the word akarma can be taken to mean inaction in the literal sense of being inactive, or it can be taken to mean inaction in the sense of non-reactive action. So, one who sees action in inaction, that means, in this case, if Arjuna chooses to be inactive, if he decides not to do anything, if he decides to renounce and go to the jungle and try to meditate, then, because he is a Kshatriya, he is not doing anything, by not doing anything, he will be doing the wrong thing. It's like a doctor who has the knowledge to treat a patient, but he does not treat the patient. And the patient dies. That is considered a crime by negligence. Or if there is a riot going on and the police comes to protect, but the police doesn't protect, then inaction is also an action. And at that time when somebody should be active, if somebody is inactive, then he will be held responsible for his inactivity. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that your inaction will cause karma. You are thinking that your action will cause karma, but actually your inaction will cause karma. Because for Kshatriya, to not protect the innocent from being hurt is actually karmically binding. And inaction in action. So just now we talked about action in inaction. That means if Arjuna is inactive, then he will be getting karma. On the other hand, to see inaction in action. That means if Arjuna is acting in a responsible, devotional way, then because he is acting for the sake of the Lord, then he will not get any reaction to the work. So in that sense, inaction refers to non-reactive work. Action in inaction refers to inactivity. So it's a buddhiman manushyeshu. Such a person is wise among all people. Yuktaha krishna karma krit. Such a person is well engaged. Even if he is doing all kinds of activities, so still he is actually not going to be bound. And the same principle of non-reactive work will be elaborated by the Lord in the next 5 verses. So, let's recite the next word. Yasya sarve samarambhah kama sankalpa varjitah jnanagnidagda karmani tamahu panditam buddhah.
Once understood to gain full knowledge, whose every endeavor is devoid of desire for sense gratification, he is saved by sages to be a worker for whom the reactions of work have been burnt up by the fire of perfect knowledge.
Yes. So here, Krishna is again not giving his judgment. He is telling, this is the judgment of the sages. So, this Krishna does in the first chapter also, that he is saying, this is the wise people consider such a person to be wise. Actually, in the first chapter, Arjuna says that, I have heard from the people. I have heard from sages that that actually those who caused ancestors to go to hell, narke niyatam vasa kulagranam kulastri, that those who caused the descendants to go the subsequent generations, the descendants to go to hell, those who destroy the dynasty, they will themselves go to hell, and they will cause their descendants also to go to hell. This I have heard from reliable sources. So Krishna is now telling that, but actually the sages, what they say is, who is actually free from activity? Yasya sarve samarambhaha. So Arambha means to begin. Samarambha means endeavor which starts. So, one who does any endeavor, yasya sarve samarambha, kam sankalpa varjitaha. So, sankalpa is the resolution. We have our sankalpa camp for people to take resolution. So, kama sankalpa means it is a resolution based on selfish desire. Varjitaha, that is just freed from. Because a person, when his endeavors are freed from selfish desire, jnanagni dagdha karmanam. So, jnanagni, the fire of knowledge, what will it do? Dagdha. It will burn karmanam. That means the karmic reactions which are going to come, they will be burned by knowledge. So, we know in the Brahma Samhita, it talks about how bhakti fries the seeds. And that's why the reactions roll from. Krishna is not yet talking about bhakti in the Bhagavad Gita. He's talking at the level of jnana. Can jnana also burn the seeds? Yes, it can. Because a person, if he's not selfishly motivated, he does not get any selfish reactions. Now, is he selflessly motivated? Is he divinely motivated? Not yet. He might be motivated even just by the desire for liberation, which is at one level a selfish desire. But another level, as compared to the gross selfish desires, is not so selfish. So of course, in this chapter, Krishna will later talk about devotion to Him in relatively clear terms, but it will not be emphatic till the 7th chapter. In the 6th chapter also there are hints, 5th chapter also there are hints. Krishna is progressing. So here he is talking primarily about Karma Yoga. So Krishna is telling that jnanagni dagdha karmanam. If one has knowledge that I am not the body, I am the soul, and one acts for the interests of the soul and does bodily activities only as much as is required, and such a person, for him the karmic reactions will be burned. And then how does the thing happen? Krishna will elaborate in the next verse. Tyaktva karma phala sangam nityadrupto nirashrayaha karmanya vipravrittopi naiva kinchit karoti saha.
Abandoning all attachment to the results of his activities, ever satisfied and independent, he performs no fruitful action, although engaged in all kinds of undertaking.
Tyaktva karma phala sangam. So one who gives sangha is attachment to the fruits of the work. Nitya trupto nirashrayaha. Nitya trupto is always self-satisfied. Nirashrayaha, he does not take shelter. Now this nirashrayaha, he is not there talking in terms of not taking shelter of the Supreme Lord. He is talking about, in the 6th chapter, 1st verse, Lord Krishna will tell, anashrutaha karma phalam karyam karma karotiya. So he is not taking shelter of the fruit of the work. You know, in material life, sometimes when people are working, you know, the stress of the work becomes too much. Then they think, oh, if I just tolerate this, if I go through this, then, you know, I'll get a promotion. Or I'll get a salary with which I'll go to a hill station. And then I will enjoy. Or I'll get a big house and I'll stay in that house. Or I'll get a new car and they have the dreams of those cars and the houses and the hill stations and whatever. So, they take shelter of the fruit of the work in order to tolerate the difficulties. But a devotee doesn't take shelter of the fruit of the work. A devotee takes shelter of Krishna. So here nirashraya means that a person is not taking shelter of anything material. Tattva karma phala sangam. That a person is not attached to the fruits of the work. So he is not taking shelter of the fruits of the work. So this is actually a great mystery of the Bhagavad Gita, that generally speaking, all of us are motivated to do something by the desire for the fruit. And we may say, even if you look at the lives of devotees, you know, Prabhupada was trying to preach in India, and Prabhupada didn't get any success, so he went to America. Now we may say, you know, he was also motivated by the desire for the fruit. So he also wanted the preaching results. And Prabhupada also said that devotees are opportunists. Opportunist means wherever we get the opportunity to preach Krishna consciousness, we will preach. And in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Leela, when Lord Chaitanya starts off on the pilgrimage of South India, chapter 7. So there Prabhupada describes that Lord Chaitanya did not manifest initially his great potency when he was living in Navadvip. But when he went to South India, he manifested his full potential, flooded all of South India with Krishna consciousness. And there he says that a preacher will always see where the situation is receptive. If the situation is not receptive, then he will go to some other situation. And he will preach over there. Now, many of you were preaching in Bangalore, but you didn't get much results. So you decided to go somewhere else and preach. Then how are we tyaktva karma phala sangam? How are we not attached to the fruits of the work? If we see it, practically even our devotional life, we are concerned about the fruits. So there's a difference between being attached to the fruits and being concerned about the fruits. Now, if we are not concerned about the service that we are doing and the result the service is going to produce, then that is a sign of our lack of devotion to Krishna. Because we want to offer the best to Krishna. If we are not concerned about what we are offering to Krishna, then surely our devotion is deficient. Even Hanuman went to Lanka, he was not detached whether I will be able to find Sita or not. I was so attached to finding Sita. When he felt that I cannot find Sita. And he was searching, he couldn't find Sita. Then he thought, if I can't find Sita, then what will I do? If I go back and tell Lord Ram that I could not find Sita, he's suffering so much. He will die in separation of Sita. And if he will die seeing him, Lakshman will die. And seeing Ram and Lakshman perishing, Sugriva will die. And when the Ayodhyavasis come to know, then all the Ayodhyavasis will die. When the Kishkindavasis come to know that Sugriva has died, Ram and Lakshman, then they will die. And when Ayodhyavasis and Krishnavasis will die, the whole world will suffer and die. And I will be responsible for it all. So, no, I must fight for the Sita. So, he has completely become determined. And as he is on top of a big building, he is looking there in the sun. As he is completely depressed, suddenly the moon comes out from the clouds. And the moon comes out, he sees in the distance a garden. And he thinks, maybe this garden is where Mother Sita will be. And he goes there and he finds it. So, a devotee is surely concerned about the results. But, a devotee is not attached to the results. You see, the other example, Jatayu knew that he would not be able to stop Ravana. And if he had been attached to the result, he would have said, the result is not going to come, let me not endeavor. But, what did he do? He says, I have to show my concern. And for my showing my concern, showing my love for the Lord, I have to fight. So that's why, if we see this same principle when it is elaborated earlier in 2.47, Krishna gives four components of it. Karmanne vadhikaraste, you have a right to perform your prescribed duty. But mahapaleshi padachana. But don't be attached to the fruit. Now, if somebody says, if I'm not going to get the fruit, then let me not work only. But we say, Jatayu, you see the example? Ma karma phala bhairturbhut, ma te sangostva karmani. Jatayu told him that, actually, you cannot take Mother Sita as long as I am alive. He knew that he was old and Ravana was young and Ravana was wicked. Now Ravana was also quite old at that time, but he had not physically aged because of the benedictions of Brahmaji, whereas Jatayu had physically aged. So, mate sangostva karmani. So, it may think that if I am not going to get the result, why should I not work? Continue to work. So, for a devotee, his concern primarily is to please the Lord. His concern is not to get the result. The getting the result is a part of pleasing the Lord. But his primary concern is to please the Lord. So, for the sake of pleasing the Lord, he is ready to sacrifice everything. He is ready to take any difficulty, even if the difficulty is overwhelming. Even if the likelihood of success is very remote, still he will take up that difficulty. So, in that sense, what is the attachment of a devotee? It is not to the fruits of the work. It is to the Supreme Lord. And because the attachment is to the Supreme Lord, therefore a devotee is able to offer his best endeavor to try to get the result for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. But even if after one's best effort, the results don't come, a devotee understands, okay, this is the will of the Lord, I accept it. Prabhupada writes in the first canto, when things are beyond human control, then there is nothing to regret over there. When something goes wrong due to factors beyond human control, we plan a camp very systematically, and then suddenly we have called the preachers, we have booked the venue, we have spent the lakshmi, we have all the arrangements, suddenly the college reschedules and puts a midterm exam over there. So, what can we do at that time? So now, on one side, a materialistic person will get frustrated, oh, my planning went wrong. But a devotee understands that, okay, the Lord had some other plan. We don't become discouraged. If we are motivated only by the fruit, if the fruit doesn't come, we will become discouraged. But if we are motivated by the desire to please the Lord, then irrespective of whether the fruit comes or not, we know that our endeavor is going to please the Lord. And that's why, if you remember in the second chapter, Krishna is saying, Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha. That Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha, Prabhupada explains differently from the Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha they explain in 4.10. There, Prabhupada, in 4.10, Prabhupada explains Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha to be attachment to the material world, fear of personal identity in the spiritual world, and anger because of not understanding which of the different philosophies is true. But if you look at 2.55, when Prabhupada is talking about 2.56, there Prabhupada explains in that purport that a devotee is not attached to the result. A devotee is not afraid that if I endeavor, if I don't succeed, oh, what will happen to my reputation? What will happen to... He is not fearful. And even after endeavoring, the result doesn't come, he doesn't get angry. Why is this happening? That is the meaning of Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha. So Prabhupada explains that in a more devotional context over there. That's why Tattva Karma Phala Sangam, the detachment of a devotee is different from the carelessness of an irresponsible person. A student is a study only, I don't care for the results. That is not detachment, that is irresponsibility. So detachment and irresponsibility are very different things. Irresponsibility means one doesn't do one's duty. Detachment means one does do one's duty, but one is not emotionally involved with the result. One is not emotionally dominated by the hopes and the dreams of getting the result. One is actually interested only in pleasing the Lord. Unfortunately, if detachment is mistaken for irresponsibility, then that can lead to a lot of confusion. We see this happening many times in India in material life. People get frustrated and they say, now I want to renounce the world. I don't know. No, renunciation is not for the irresponsible people. Going through often tells this this cutting joke. He says, once a husband and wife had a quarrel. So the husband told his wife, you know, if you continue behaving like this, I will take sannyas. The wife told him, don't spoil the sannyas ashram.
So, the point is that actually,
frustration can be one motivation for renunciation. But the nature of the material world is that, material world never makes us permanently frustrated. It makes us frustrated and again gives us some hope. So, if our motivation for spirituality is only the frustration in material life, when the frustration in material life goes away, again, we will become attracted to material life. And then we will become indifferent, or lose about our spiritual life. That's why, don't spoil the sannyasa ashram. If somebody is going towards renunciation just because of frustration, then again he will become attached when there are hopes of material enjoyment. And then, that such a person can become a blemish on the renounced order. So, the motivation for spirituality, for renunciation is actually a higher taste. Or if not a higher taste, at least a higher knowledge. It is not just frustration with material life. That's why in the previous verse Krishna said, Jnanagni Dagdha Karmanam. That person has to have knowledge. That I am not this body. I have nothing to do with this body. And things related with the body do not actually affect me. Although I may have to maintain this body for the sake of living. But I am not really very intimately or deeply connected with this body. So, If a person has this consciousness, if he is not attached to the fruits of the work, then karmanya abhipravruttopi. Even if he is engaged in karma, he will not be bound. Then, we just complete this section, then we will have some questions. So, let's go to the next verse now. Nirashiraya chittatma tyakta sarva parigraha shariram kevalam karma kurvannapnoti kilvisham.
That's a man of understanding, acts with mind and intelligence perfectly controlled, gives up all sense of proprietorship over his possessions, and acts only for the bare necessities of life. Thus working, he is not affected by sinful reactions.
So, nirashira yachittatma. So, if you see the word nirasha in actually Sanskrit and in Hindi, the word nirasha has a very negative connotation in Hindi. Nirasha ho gaya hai. He's become dejected, he's become hopeless. But nirasha has a relatively positive connotation in Sanskrit. As we know, Pingala says, Asha hi paramam dukkham, nirasha paramam sukham. That the desire, the hope for material enjoyment is the cause of misery. As Lord Krishna also tells Uddhava, dukkham kama sukha peksha. He says that as long as one is hoping and having expectation that I will get happiness through sense gratification, till that time he will constantly be agitated. His mind will be tortured and therefore he will be miserable. So therefore, Asha hi paramam dukkham, the hope for material sense gratification is the cause of misery. And nirasha paramam sukham. So the word nirasha in Sanskrit doesn't mean dejection or hopelessness. It means freedom from material desires. Freedom from material desires. Nirashira yata chittatma. The person who is self-controlled. Tekta sarva parigraha. That one who has actually given up all sense of proprietorship. In yoga also, in the Yama and Niyama, one of the first things is aparigraha, non-possessiveness. Now, a devotee does take care of everything that he has in his care, but he is non-possessive about it. Non-possessive means, he understands that actually it is Krishna who has put this in my care, and if Krishna wants, he can take it away from me anytime. So, you know, for us, we can become very possessive sometimes about our services. This is my service. And somebody tells you, no, please don't take up some other service. Oh, no, this service cannot go on without me. The service actually is not that we are doing it and we should not be attached even to our service. Of course, we should be attached to the principle of being the servant. But if the Vaishnavas want us to serve in some other way, then we should be ready for that. Tyakta sarva parigraha. So, shariram kevalam karma. Shariram kevalam karma means only for the sake of bodily maintenance one does work. So now Prabhupada explains in the purports in this section that a surrendered soul is like an animal. An animal is simply obeying his master. And sometimes the master may even kill the animal. But the animal doesn't protest. Animal accepts. This may seem like too much servility. Why should we not protest? But the principle Prabhupada is talking about is a pure devotee reciprocating with the Lord. He's not talking about a material master and a material servant. Actually, we have to understand very carefully how we apply spiritual principles. You know, if somebody is exploiting somebody in material life, does it mean that to tolerate that exploitation, tattenu kampam sasamikshamano? Not necessarily. And if somebody is abusing, somebody is exploiting, if you see the Pandavas could have tolerated all the abuse that the Kauravas were doing, and they could have said, Tattenu kampam sasamikshamano. But that is not what is expected of them, because they are Kshatriyas, they have a responsibility. Similarly, if we see in our life, if somebody is abusing us, then we do have a right to protest. We do have a right to seek redressal. But again, when we seek redressal, it is not in the mood of vengeance. It is in the mood of service. You know, that particular person, if he is doing something, if he is abusing us, he might be abusing others also. And we don't want the Vaishnava community to be spoiled. We don't want devotees to become discouraged by that abuse. And that person is abusing, he is actually doing harm to himself. He is actually harming his own bhakti. So we have to save him from that. That's why bhakti does not mean being passive towards everything. Actually, we do the best that we can, but sometimes even after doing the best, things just don't work. Things just stay the way they are. Then we have to tolerate and go ahead. So, shariram kevalam karma. And when a devotee works, he is primarily focused on not just aggrandizing his wealth more and more. He is concerned with, basically, let me maintain myself. Let me maintain myself so that I can dedicate my life to Krishna. And this connection is very important, that we surround ourselves with the devotee association more and more. Because our desires and our values are greatly influenced by the people with whom we live. You know, if we are primarily surrounded by materialistic people, then we will get explicit and implicit messages that we always try to boost up our material life. Now you have a small vehicle, you get a bigger vehicle. You have a small house, you get a bigger house. And this whole peer pressure becomes so much that a person just cannot live simply. Even if he wants to, he cannot. So if we may have to work in a company where we are surrounded by colleagues who are all materialistic, but we should not. We should also have a very strong devotee association. And strong devotee association means, it's not that the devotees are physically strong, that is not strong devotee association. It's also not the number of devotees that are there around us. What it means is that our strong emotional involvement should be with devotees and not with non-devotees. That means, as devotees, we should be more concerned about what Krishna and the Vaishnavas feel about us and not what materialistic people feel about us. Actually, shariram kevalam karma, to live a simple lifestyle is not at all possible if we take the opinions of materialistic people too seriously. Now, we want to be competent in our material life. You know, our life should be in such a way that even the materialistic people should not feel that a devotee is irresponsible. To do our work in a competent way. But do your work in a competent way doesn't mean that we have to adopt their values. We can do our work in a competent way without becoming materialistic like them. So, actually, for how does shariram kevalam karma work for a devotee? We don't just work for a living. We just don't work for a living. We have our savings, and we often have a lot more. So, as devotees, we may also, for the sake of our preaching, need some respectability in life, society. So that we can preach, especially if we are going to be householders in future, or if we are householders now, then there may be a certain amount of respectability that is required in society so that we can preach effectively. So, somebody who has in the past been a millionaire and he becomes a devotee, then for him, shariram kevalam karma will not mean that he just gets he has to downgrade his lifestyle to a very, very simple lifestyle where he's just earning a hand to mouth existence. That's not necessary. The principle of shariram kevalam karma is not how much you are earning. If a person has a particular lifestyle, it doesn't necessarily have to come down from that lifestyle. But the important thing is, how much time is it taking? How much time is it taking? Some people have talent, some people have contacts, some people have inheritance. So, they may be living relatively opulently, but they should not get too involved in it. The time, energy, emotions should not get too involved in it. So, if somebody that opulent position in society, through that opulent position he can preach quite effectively. People will see that, oh, person is so wealthy and still spiritually minded. And somebody is middle class and people can relate with that person also, yes. Although he has all the struggles and tensions that I have, the insecurities that I have, but still he is also practicing devotional service. So, when we talk about shariram kevalam karma, the practical application is that a devotee doesn't try to dramatically change his material status. If you are already at a high material status, it's not that you have to take a very, very simple living. If somebody is very simple, it's not that he has to aspire that. Let me work so hard and let me earn a lot of money. Then when I am very wealthy, then people will see that such a wealthy person is also a devotee. Then they will also become devotees. No, we don't have to bother about that. whatever status we have been put in, we accept that status and continue our devotional service. That's what Krishna tells in the next verse. Yadrucha labha santushto dandvatito vimatsaraha samasiddhava siddhavcha karpapina nibadhyate.
He who is satisfied with gain which comes out of its own accord, who is free from duality and does not envy, who is steady in both success and failure, is never entangled, although performing actions.
Yes. Yadrucha labha santushto. Yadrucha means by its own accord, by the arrangement of providence, by divine will. Whatever gain comes by divine will, labha santushto. A devotee is satisfied by that. So, now whatever kind of karma we have, whatever the destiny that is there, we'll be at whatever level in our material life. You know, we don't have to bother too much about improving that. Yadrucha labha santushto. Dvandvatito vimatsaraha. So, how can one actually be satisfied with what we have? One has to be dvandvatito. One should not be too bothered by material dualities. Later on, in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in 9.32-33, Prabhupada is talking about Aityam Sukham Lokamim Prapti Bhajasvama. That purport Prabhupada explains that actually, there are these dualities in the material world. There is healthy, sick, wealthy, poor, intelligent, mediocre. But you see, the fact of the matter is that nobody is happy in this world. You acknowledge the duality. But generally, when we are poor, we think if I just become wealthy, I'll become happy. You know, somebody is traveling in a crowded local. And then you see somebody is traveling comfortably in a car. And if only I had a car, I'll also travel so comfortably. But actually, to have that car and to maintain that car, there are so many other associated anxieties which come up. So, actually, dvandvatita. The wealthy and the poor, the healthy and the sick, everybody has their problems in the material world. So, that's how a devotee becomes dvandvatita. By understanding, by pratyaksha it appears as if, you know, one side of duality is very bad and the other side of duality is very good. But actually, if we understand through Shabda, then both sides of the duality are still bad only. And that's why, if a person is dvandvatita, then he will be vimatsaraha. Matsara means envy. Because if we get the, what people call as a raw deal in life, you know, we are working in a company, somebody else gets the promotion, I don't get the promotion, then it's natural to become envious. But we understand that actually the person may have got promotion, but still, you know, it's not that by that promotion is going to become happy. As it is said, I think we mentioned this, uneasy is the head that wears the crown. You know, in material life, somebody has a lot of position and a lot of prestige. The person is very fearful, insecure. Uneasy is the head, that is the saying, that wears the crown. Because who knows, somebody will just sort of cut off the head. Is it not to get the crown again? So kings and wealthy people, they often live very insecure lives. That's why vimatsaraha. Everybody understands this. Material dualities, they cannot actually make a real difference. From material point of view, they make a difference, but that is superficial. From a devotional point of view, they don't make any difference. And samasiddhava siddhavcha. Therefore, when the success or failure comes, equipoise. And if you can do like that, then na nibadhyate, such a person will not be bound. So what is the discussion having to do with Arjuna's context? Actually, Arjuna is fighting, and you cannot fight unless you are motivated by the desire to win. Arjuna, when he is shooting arrows later on at Karana, he thought, oh, even if this arrow kills him, doesn't kill him, I don't mind. He will not be able to fight like that. Actually, if you see, what follows after this profoundly philosophical dialogue of the Bhagavad Gita is a graphically passionate war. So how do you reconcile the two? Actually, if passion is required for a body activity, a devotee, then you dotail that passion. You dotail that passion and you can use that passion. But we see that every morning, you know, when Arjuna would wake up, he would offer his obeisances to Krishna, he would pray. to the Lord, and he would, with the blessing, start the fight. Every night, as soon as the battle would get over, at least the initial few days when they were not fighting at night, now when the battle would get over, he would get out of the chariot, he would pray to the Lord, offer his obeisances, and then then he would return. So, you know, a devotee, if a service requires passion, a devotee is not afraid of passion. But he doesn't get controlled by passion. How? He does not give up his devotional regulations. If in the name of service, we become passionate, and the passionate takes so much control of our life, that we give up our devotional regulations, then we will become dominated by passion. Then we will be carried away by passion. But certain services may require passion, and a devotee can take up that passion, but not at the cost of his basic devotional regulation. Sometimes, when a lot of services are there, at that time, we will not be able to read regularly, we will not be able to do our sadhana very nicely. These situations should not be happening regularly. If they are happening all the time, then that means we have to organize our life better. There is some management required, there is some consultation and restructuring of our life required. But if it happens occasionally, you have to be ready for that. It's part of life. So, then Krishna will describe the same principle in the next verse further. Gata sangasya muktasya jnanavastita chetasaha jnayacharata karma samagram praviliyate.
The work of a man who is unattached to the modes of material nature and who is fully situated in transcendental knowledge merges entirely into transcendence.
As devotees, whenever we see the word merge, we get a little frightened.
But
a merge is a common word in the scriptures. We can't run away from that word. You know, we see that Sarvam Bhattacharya also, he wanted to change mukti pade to bhakti pade. So actually, after we become devotees, anything that has an impersonal connotation, we tend to recoil from that. But you know, impersonal realization is also part of the realization of the absolute truth. That's not wrong in that sense. So here what he is saying? Praviliyate. Praviliyate means to merge. But what is merging? It is not that the doer is merging, the action is merging. So that means the action is becoming transcendental. The action is merging into transcendence. Gata sangasya muktasya. The same thing. Sang by from attachment, Krishna, the person is free. Jnana vastita chetasaha. Earlier Krishna said in 19 verse, Jnana vidagda karmana. So now he is describing that actually not just the work is done with jnana, the consciousness is permeated with jnana. Jnana vastita chetasaha. The person is situated in knowledge, his consciousness is fixed in the knowledge that I am not the body and the soul. And yajnaya acharataha karma. So this is the first time in this chapter that Krishna brings the concept of yajna. In the third chapter, he has talked about it elaborately. And in fact, this word, yajnaya acharataha karma, is a seed for the subsequent 10 verses which will come after this, 11 verses which will come after this, from 24 to 33. 10 verses. So, yajnaya acharata karma. So, yajna, as we know, it means sacrifice. Sacrifice basically means that whatever is dear for us, whatever we could use for our pleasure, we offer for the pleasure of the Lord. So, literally speaking, you know, we could make nice food with ghee and we would eat that food, but we put the ghee into fire. So, what could be used for our enjoyment, we offer that for the Lord's enjoyment. That is the essence of yajna. Yajna is not just necessarily a fire sacrifice, especially in the next verses. Krishna will give a very broad understanding of yajna. And he will say that so many, even pranayama can be a yajna. And fighting on a battlefield can be a yajna. Because it's not the activity, it's the principle. The principle is that which is dear to us, we offer for the pleasure of the Lord. We sacrifice for the pleasure of the Lord. The English word sacrifice comes from the Latin root sacros, which means to make sacred. So when we sacrifice something, we make it sacred. That was the original connotation. So now, the next verse. ब्रह्मार्पणं ब्रह्महवे ब्रह्माग्नौ ब्रह्मणाहुतम् ब्रह्मैव तेन गन्तव्यम् ब्रह्मकर्म समाधिना. So, now Krishna is saying that whole, that word praviyate here is elaborate. What is that merging that takes place? And the merging is also associated with Brahma. So the, all the Brahma word comes. How many times? 6 times it comes. Brahma arpanam brahmavi, brahmagna brahmana avatam, brahmaivate na kantavyam, brahma karma samadhina. 6 times. So, this is one of the puzzling verses of the Gita. Puzzling for devotees, popular for non-devotees, for my impersonalists. Because it talks about, you see, everything is one. But in what sense is it one? Prabhupada writes in the purport that actually everything is the absolute truth. When absolute truth is covered by Maya, that is called as matter. Everything is the absolute truth. When absolute truth is covered by Maya, by illusion, then it is called as matter. So matter is also an analogy of God. So Chakravarti Pad gives a very graphic explanation of this verse. He says, oh Arjuna, now in the previous verse, yajnaya acharatah karma. That now you have to do yajna. So now I am going to tell you what yajna you have to do. He says, yes, Arjuna is saying very nice. I will put out my battlefield. Let's do yajna. I will become a Brahman. That's what I wanted. He says, no, your yajna is a special yajna. He says, what is the yajna? The yajna kunda is the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Your yajna spoon is your Gandiva. And your ahuti is the Kauravas. And the fire in which you are going to offer it is your arrows. So it's Brahmarpanam Brahmahave. So that which is offered, that into which it is offered, it's all Brahman. And that who he is offering, he is Brahman. He who, what is going to be gotten by that is also Brahman. Brahmarpanam Brahmahave, Brahmagna, the fire is Brahman. Brahmanahutam, that which is offered, that is also Brahman. And Brahmaivatena Gantavyam, what will be attained ultimately is Brahman. Brahma karma samadhina, the person who is doing that activity is also Brahman. So, if you look at it from a literal point of view, when the yajna is done, if the yajna is done in proper consciousness, then actually by the presence of the absolute truth, everything becomes transcendental. In the third chapter, when Krishna is talking about Annad Bhavanti Bhutani, that is 3.14, in the 15th verse he says, karma brahmodham vitti brahmakshara samudhavam tasmat sarvagatam brahma nityam yajna pratishtitam. So same point. Whenever yajna is performed, that all pervading transcendence, tasmat sarvagatam brahma nityam yajna pratishtitam, is always present in yajna. That means the transcendence is all pervading, but we can't access the all pervading transcendence. But when we do sacrifice, then that all pervading transcendence becomes manifest to us. It becomes accessible to us. So when a traditional yajna is performed, so if it's done in proper consciousness, then the fire is spiritual. The ghee or the silk or whatever is offered, that is also sacred, that is spiritual. The priest who is doing the yajna, he is also spiritual. The yajman, the host for whom the yajna is being performed, he is also spiritual. And that Lord who is satisfied by that, he is also spiritual. The benefit that the performers get, that benefit is also spiritual. In this way, everything is spiritualized. And what is it that spiritualizes everything? That is the motivation, that is the consciousness. So, this is the essential principle here. Hey, now, if Krishna is not telling that everything merges into one, that there is no, that the doer, the action, the beneficiary of the action, everything is merging into one in a ontological or existential sense. He is saying, it's not in the existential sense that everything becomes one, but in the level of consciousness, everything becomes spiritualized. And now in the next verses onwards, so here Krishna tells the principle. Now Arjuna may wonder, what kind of yajna is this? You know, you're fighting. I never heard of bows and arrows being used in yajna, and the battlefield being a yajna. Krishna says, oh, there are many different kinds of yajnas. At that level, he will start telling many different types of yagyas to us. Daivam eva pare yagyam yogina paryupasate nava pare yagyam yagye naivo pajuvati. Now, apart from the paradharma of devotional service to Supreme Lord, there are two other Vedas. One is worship of the impersonal Brahman, and the second is demigod worship. Krishna is saying these are also yajna. So that's why generally we don't consider demigod worshippers to be yogis. So Prabhupada, Krishna is not using the word yogi, yoginaha paripasate. They are yogi in the restricted sense of a person who performs pranayama. He is one who is striving for a connection with the Absolute Truth. So, when they offer some bhoga to the, some sort of yajna for the pleasure of the demigod also, that is also a form of yajna. And similarly, brahmagnav apare yajnam, yajne naivo pajuvati. So, when somebody is actually trying to meditate on the Brahman, then that is also a form of yajna. How is that a yajna? One is meditating. One could use one's consciousness, so many other things. One is trying to think, nighty. One is just trying to find the Absolute Truth. So, that's also a form of yajna. And so, after talking about demigod worshippers and impersonalists, then Krishna talks about within the normal way of life, the brahmacharis and the grihasthas in the next verse. So, shrotra dinindriyanyanye sanyamagni shujuvati shabda dinvishayanyanye indriyagni shujuvati. And you wonder, what is fire of senses?
So, now that it is clear that this is being used in an allegorical sense, in a metaphorical sense.
So, yajna is not just an activity where you put some ingredients in fire. But, the essential principle is that which we could use for enjoyment, we use it for the service of the Lord. We sacrifice it for a higher purpose. So, first thing is, shrotradi indriyanye sanyamagni shujuhuvati. So, for those who are in the renounced order, that there are so many subjects which we can hear about. But we take our senses and we offer them in the fire of mental control. That means, we engage the senses only for the purpose of Supreme Lord. That's why the first instruction, among the first instructions that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave to Raghunath Das Goswami was, Gramya Vartana Kahive, Gramya Vartana Shunive. Don't talk about mundane subject matters. Don't hear mundane subject matters. So actually, to a large extent, our desires are stimulated by hearing. You know, that's why Prahlada also says, Shruti Sukha Mruga Trishni Rupa. He said, he calls something Shruti Sukha. We keep hearing about it. You know, yes, Maya also comes in when we see a lot of things. But even after seeing, when we hear, then that hearing often stimulates the imagination. And so, Shrotradi Indriyan Anye. There are so many things which you can hear about, there are so many things which you can see. But a devotee, a transcendent, especially here, talking about one who is in the renounced order, now they use their senses only for whatever is necessary for the service of the Supreme Lord. So that's why they have to sacrifice the senses. That means, now if from a material point of view, the senses can do so many things which can give you pleasure. You know, we can eat so many things and we get some pleasure. But we'll eat only those things which are offered to Krishna. So that's how the senses are offered in the fire of mental control. Senses are engaged only for the service of Supreme Lord. And then, so for those in the renounced order, there is no contact between the senses and the sense objects. So therefore, the sacrifice is what? The senses, whenever they want to contact with the sense object, the senses are withdrawn and they are brought in connection with the mind. And the mind is fixed on Krishna. That's the sacrifice. Now for those who are householders, what is the sacrifice? Senses are allowed to come in contact with sense objects, but that is regulated. The sense objects are not engaged for our service, they are also engaged in Krishna's service. So, shabdadin vishayan anye indriyagni shujuvati. So, you know, a householder has his wife, he has his family, his children, relatives, but he tries to engage all of them in devotional service. He tries to see that they are not my property, they are actually Krishna's property. They are kept under my care. And they are not for my enjoyment, they are for my service. Not my service, and they say they should serve me, rather I should serve them. So with that consciousness, even family life also becomes a yajna, it becomes spiritual life. And then even the household life also does not lead to any obstacle in spiritual advancement. Now the difference is that to some extent, you know, offering the senses in the mind is easier because the senses don't have a free will. Offering the sense objects to the senses is more difficult because the sense objects have their own free will. And that means when we have to try to engage other people in devotional service, certainly engaging our own senses in devotional service is difficult. But ultimately if we make our determination, we make our resolution, it's possible. But if you have to engage other people in devotional service, they have their mind, they have their senses, they have their free will, it is much more difficult. So in that sense, there is more freedom for enjoyment, but along with more freedom for enjoyment comes more complication also. But the general principle which Krishna is going to illustrate in these verses is that yajna, or Arjuna, don't think that it is just an activity that you do in the on the altar in the fire sacrifice. Yajna is a principle that can pervade all of existence. And Krishna is going to talk about this because he is going to tell Arjuna that even your battle is a yajna. So Krishna will continue with in the next verses about by talking about the pranayama that we will discuss tomorrow. I'll quickly summarize and then we can have one question. We discussed today about, we completed the Karma Yoga section. We discussed the difference between detachment and irresponsibility, and how a devotee works according to whatever his talents are, whatever situation is, so that he doesn't get too emotionally entangled or too entangled in terms of time in his worldly life. And then we discussed about how yajna is an all-pervading activity. By the consciousness of wanting to sacrifice that which can give us pleasure for a higher purpose, even seemingly ordinary activities can become a yajna, can become spiritualized. Yes, no? Any question? Yeah. Many times we can't understand what is the best efforts, whether we have put in our best or not. Yes, that is something which is subjective. It's in one sense something like, how do you know whether you have eaten enough or not? It's subjective. Nobody can tell. This much is enough for you. Don't need more. Sometimes we might be hungry. We might have a high digestive system. So it's, we learn by experience. We learn by experience. Sometimes we feel, oh, I should decrease my diet. I decrease it by much, and then I feel I'm really hungry throughout the day. Then I feel I'm hungry. I keep eating. This is too much. I'm feeling sleepy. I'm feeling bored. So we learn by experience how much we should eat. Similarly, what is our best? We also learn that by experience. That means that, you know, our best in one field should not be at the compromise of, you know, of the worst in another field. That means, you know, I am the best devotee as far as service is concerned, but then I am the worst student when I go to college. No.
If somebody does like that, you know, the best will backfire for the organization and for that particular person also.
So, you know, when we talk about best, it's not just best in one field. It's best in practically in all the fields of our life. So that we have to strike a balance. You know, we can say that, you know, I can do service so much, I can do follow-up and I will come back and every night I will sleep at 1 o'clock. And I'm working so hard in my preaching. But then we don't want such a best in preaching that, you know, that is constantly sleeping in japa time. So, in that sense, we have to have a balance. And one of the primary factors in determining what is our best is, it's better to try for a good in all the fields of our life than try to have a best in one field and then we flop in all the other fields. So, that's why, often what we think is that we are not putting in good efforts, putting our best efforts. You think, I could have done more in this, I could have done more in this. Yes, we can always do more in each field. But then, it's not that we have only one field to work in. We have our service, we have our sadhana,
we may have our family, we may have our profession, we may have many different, for example, if you are counseling, you can give so many hours to a devotee, upcoming one, and then he may be very grateful, but what about other services? So therefore, we have to balance. And that's why, you know, if we have a time-bound consciousness, listen, this, I have only 2 hours from this now. Therefore, then we can put in our, concentrate our effort during those 2 hours. Sometimes you sit down to chant and think, oh, my whole life I have to chant every day like this. So the whole motivation of chanting will go away. But if you think, now I have so many things to do in my life, if I don't improve my chanting in these 2 hours, I'll never be able to improve my chanting. It's not that in the future I will have such a leisurely life that I can chant 64 rounds, and then I can think of improving my chanting. No, this is the time I have. In this time, let me offer my best. So, recognizing the different roles that we have to play in our life, and then allocating time, and realizing this is all that I can offer. I would like to, but I cannot offer more. You know, if I get in the opportunity, I would like to study all day. But no, I can't study Prabhupada books all day. Then if I have only half an hour to study, then let me do the best service to Prabhupada that I can in half an hour. So realizing that we have limited time that can bring out our best within the constraints that we have. But often we think of best in terms of, you know, giving unlimited to one particular activity, which is practically not possible. Or we think of reserving the best for a future when more conducive situations will come. But that is also not going to work. So in the situation that I am, let me do the best that I can. Yes, you know, I'm feeling sick. I didn't sleep well last night, so I'm feeling sleepy right now. So therefore, I can't chant very nicely. But what is the best that I can chant now? Let me try that. And over a period of time, we will understand. Now, as I said, sometimes we eat too much and then we decrease. Or we put in too much endeavor in one thing and then we decrease it. Or sometimes we say, no, I could have done more over here. So, that's why introspection is important for a devotee. Introspection means, you know, we look back at our life and we see what is the quality of the service that I am doing. You know, yes, could I have done this better in the available time? We shouldn't say that just to do something better means I have to provide more time. If we can, that is fine. But generally, it is very difficult. So, doing introspection about the services that we do, that means after we have done a day's service or a week's service, we look back and think, okay, this is what this I did. And then one devotee asked Prabhupada, I think Brahmanand Prabhu asked, Prabhupada, how should we feel after we give a class? Prabhupada said, should feel, hey, I didn't speak this verse, you know. I didn't speak this point, I didn't speak this. He said, you should always feel that you could have done the service better. So, you know, if we give a class and then others come and appreciate. See, what happens when you give class, generally speaking, those who don't like the class, they just go away. And those who like the class, they will come and appreciate. So, we get a very one-sided perception. So that's why, you know, we have to be honest with ourselves and we have to evaluate. You know, I could have spoken this point, I could have done this, I could have spoken done this. So we have to always be in the self-improvement mode. And that is possible only when we are doing introspection. So 3 points. First is that we should not do best in one field at the expense of other fields. Second is understand that I have limited time for each activity. So let me offer the best within that. And to evaluate that, we can think of, we can introspect to see whether I could have done better within the constraints that I have. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vinda ki, Gai Gaur Premanande. Hare Krishna.